Hey there, I'm Sean Finnegan, and you are listening to Restitutio, a podcast that seeks to recover authentic Christianity and live it out today.
Seneca Harbin became a Christian later in life through reading the Bible. However, when he was attending a megachurch in Indianapolis, he started hearing the pastor preach about Christ in a way that seemed bizarre and unbiblical. To his surprise, Seneca discovered that the vast majority of Christians held to these extra-biblical speculations about multiple persons and the Godhead and dual natures of Christ. This set him on a quest to find others who, like him, prefer to stop where Scripture stops and understand Jesus as the Messiah, not a God-man. After relating his own spiritual journey, he talks about his recent book, The Cost of Truth, which adds in the testimonies of several others, including Bill Schlegel, Will Barlow, Johnny Barnes, Seth Ross, Suzanne Lakin, Candace Tuggy, and Ryan Russell. I believe this book will fire you up. It's easy to get complacent, but this little book of testimony shows us that God is not done yet. He's reaching people in our time, calling them out of darkness and confusion into his marvelous light, and Seneca does a great job talking about this book. Here now is episode 569, The Cost of Truth, with Seneca Harbin. Welcome, Seneca Harbin, to Restitutio. So glad to talk with you today. Thanks for joining me.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I'm glad to be here.
To start with, it would be good just to hear your backstory a little bit. So could you tell us about your spiritual journey? Like, for example, were you raised in a Christian home? And could you share with us a little bit about how you came to faith in Christ?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. I wasn't raised in a Christian home. My family, they're pagans and Wiccan. My mom's a witch and all that kind of stuff. I think my dad, if he would put a label on anything, he'd probably call himself a Buddhist. But I think it's just he doesn't really care enough to pick a religion or anything. He's more the guy that's like, well, you know, I'll probably just find out whenever I die or whatever. But yeah, so I didn't grow up in a Christian home. I never heard anything positive about Christianity. The Wiccan, now this is a broad stroke paintbrush here, but the Wiccan community that I'm familiar with has a very negative outlook on Christianity. So I pretty much only ever heard negative stuff. You know, those people are judgmental, they're hateful, they're hypocritical, stuff like that.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, I didn't really know any Christians or anything like that, so I wouldn't have known any different anyway. So that's kind of how I grew up. And then I don't know how far you want me to go, but as my story progresses, I kind of saw the weaponized version of religion. I didn't really know anything about organized religion. And then I saw it used as a weapon. And so I wasn't in a big hurry to get involved in that. But then I came to find Christ on my own later on. And it's a beautiful thing. I'd recommend it to everybody.
So you were kind of in a gang.
Yeah. So there's formalized gangs and then there's cliques. It depends on how big the organization is and what the region is. You know, it's gangs are surprisingly extremely well organized and they have a hierarchy and they're very militant. The community I was involved with, I was probably the youngest kid that I ran with by maybe like 10 years. And when you're a young child, that is a massive gap. So, yeah, I just ran around with criminals and drug addicts and drug dealers and gang members and did gang activity and all that good stuff.
Yeah. And then at some point you joined the military and you spent a long time in the military. How many years was that?
Well, long to some, short to others. I spent 7 years active in the United States Army Infantry. Out of those 7 years, I did 6 tours overseas. So kind of a busy career, didn't have a lot of time to sit back and enjoy it and all that good stuff. But the job I had in the military is hyper-specific. And so if I'm not overseas, I wasn't doing anything really useful anyway. So not all bad.
And you had gotten married. I don't want to give away all the details of your story because it's in the book. You got married and eventually left the military and had to figure out how to do life. You know, suddenly you didn't have all the structure and the mission.
What was that like? Maybe you could just talk about that a little bit, just coming home and facing reality with a wife and these kids.
Yeah, it's extremely difficult. One of the hardest things you can ever do in the military is get out. And that sounds really silly, especially to some people, because they've strived their whole life and they've built their careers and they've done all these crazy hard things. And if you looked at my military career and all my little silly awards and all that, you think, wow, that he must have done hard stuff. But really for me, one of the hardest parts was getting out. You go from an extremely hyper-focused, goal-oriented, mission-driven, highly focused organization with tons of support to nothing overnight. And that's a big change. One of the unique things about the military is when you go in, most people are very young. And so you go in and you have this kind of young, rebellious, headstrong mentality, and they break you of that and rebuild you into a useful tool in their machine. And then you gain all this skill and you spend your life developing the skill set that's hyper specific for the environment you're in. And then one day you get out, and so you're no longer the kid that went in. You're no longer the identity that you've built throughout your whole adult life. And now you got to go figure out life. Some people fall outside of this, but for most people, however long you've been in the service, you're just that many years behind your civilian counterparts, because they didn't go off and fight a war. They went to work, or they went to school, or they started raising a family. So all those years that they've been building, you've done amazing, wonderful things. But in the civilian sector, you're kind of just behind the times.
And what was it like on the home front?
It wasn't great. So I actually got injured overseas, and that led to me getting out of the military. So my getting out was very abrupt. I got out of the military from a foreign country. And so when I came home, it was like overnight, and it was culture shock, and it was everything that they would advise. You know, if you read any manual, they would say, don't do this because it's going to ruin this. It's going to very much shorten the proposed success rate of this individual. But now I got home, and I didn't like what I saw, you know, in the service, good or bad. I mean, it is a very specific, very niche and different culture, but the culture is super tight. And so when you get out here, you see things like socioeconomic division and racial division and nowadays gender division and all that stuff. In the military, no one cares. You don't have time to care about that stuff. So it's just, you're all part of the same team. You're all part of the same mission. You want to achieve the same goals. So it's a very united core. And then you get out and it's just a mess. Everything seems backwards. Everybody's out to get everybody else. Instead of having one individual mission that everyone's working towards, it's 8 billion missions and they're all working towards that. And they're all very self-centered and self-focused. It's just, it's really hard to get out. It's such a culture shock. Mm-hmm. If you lived in a foreign country for 40 years of your life and you came to America, it wouldn't be what you remembered it being.
Right. Yeah. And what about your wife and family? Talk about that a little bit, readjusting to being there.
The weight. Now, I don't want to say this to offend people, because I recommend, you know, every fun thing I do is because I have children. All the fun stuff, the camping trips, the memories, the, you know, going to the zoo, all the fun stuff that I'm going to remember throughout my life and the stuff I'm going to miss, all of that's because of the family. However, with that being said, the weight of a family is crushing. And so, not only did I spent several years outside of this country. So I came back. I didn't recognize the country anymore. I didn't really like what I saw. I felt very isolated. And everybody who gets out, you think you're the only person that feels that way. You're not. A lot of people get out every day, and a lot of people feel isolated and individualized and marginalized and all that kind of stuff. But then I had a wife. I had a small child. I was very fortunate. I got to see my first daughter be born But then I shipped out and I met her again when she was two. And so there's no real attachment there. There's no established relationship. All the stuff that makes them, you don't know why they're acting like that. You don't know all their personality traits. You don't know what they like and don't like and all that. And then, you know, and then I just had all my baggage. So my story is not as crazy as some people. Like I wasn't, you know, Black Ops, and I wasn't a Navy SEAL or whatever, even though I did write a book. And that's the big joke against Navy SEALs. But no, I wasn't a cool guy. I was just a rifleman. I was a shooter and I was an infantryman, but I was big arm and I was big unit tactics. So I wasn't one of the cool guys with all the funding and the gear and all the, you know, the good stuff. We were just on the move all the time. But so I got back home. I didn't really know who I was. I had all my baggage because I did six tours overseas, four of them being combat tours. So those kind of, they just change you fundamentally as a person and as a mindset. So I didn't really know who I was. I didn't know who my family was. I've been with my wife since I was 15. She was 16. And we've always been single income, and we still are today. And I'm a public servant, so I mean, nobody's balling over at the Harbin household, you know. It was so hard for me because I didn't know who my family was. I didn't know who I was. I didn't know how I fit in society. And I just did the best. I knew how to work really hard, and so I just applied that. Mm-hmm.
So why did you start going to church?
Well, my wife and I both agreed that we were trash and we were not good examples for what we would want our children to be raised as. We didn't really have, like, you know, any of the core foundational values that you want to see in a human being. We were people, and I don't think we were bad or anything, but we didn't know what right looked like. And so we thought a church could hopefully show us that. Funny story is, you know, in Indiana, where I live, you can throw a rock and you can hit five churches. Mm. And they're all like 3,000 plus member churches.
Oh, wow.
And you can hit even more churches that are like 200 people. You know, a very small church around here is about 150 people. You drive by and you're like, oh, God, they might not be there in 6 months. You know, really, it's a thriving community. But we're just so used to the vanilla, non-denominational, fake Christianity that you can pack a house. You know, if you don't ever tell them anything that's in the Bible, you can really get a lot of people to show up. we wanted to go to a church. And so I called the only guy I knew that was even had ever even spoke about his faith or anything like that. I called him and I said, I'm new to this. What do you think about this place? Mm-hmm. He's like, I've been a member there for 20 years. Come on by. So he showed us around, and I talk about him a little bit briefly in my chapter in the book, but super nice guy, just introduced us to everybody. And then that really lit a match. The church itself and the service and all this, I didn't like that, but I did like the community. It's right back to the military thinking. It's groupthink mentality. It's group identity. You have fast friends who have common interests and they want to see you do better in life and all that good stuff. So it's very familiar with the type of mindsets that I excel with.
You talk about how you kind of became a Christian in the church, and maybe you can explain your impression of that experience of just like going through the standard hoops that they have for you. And also talk about your confusion. Like, what were the things that confused you? You were like, this is weird.
Yeah, so a very unique thing about my wife and I, we had no presuppositions. We didn't have a context or a lens to look through because we were both wildly unfamiliar with the Bible. Mm-hmm. And I've got, you know, kind of a bunch of vulgar jokes and stuff I'm trying not to put in here because I don't, you know, I'm sure kids are going to watch this or whatever, but and then I won't get picked to do youth ministry at the next conference or whatever. But no, so my kids were like, hey, you know, Dad, this sucks. I'm so bored. And this guy's not funny. It's not appealing to me. I don't want to sit in the service. And I was like, well, me and you both, kids. But I didn't know that I was just there for my wife. You know, she wanted to do it. I was like, okay, whatever. As every church would have it, if you have a pulse, you can serve in children's ministry. I did have a pulse, but I'd never read the Bible, and didn't believe in Jesus, and it just, you know, it was whatever. But all I'd ever heard, again, going back to my ignorance, I had only heard negative things about children's ministry and what happens to kids at church and all that stuff. So I was like, well, if you're not ever going to be out of my sight in this building, well, they didn't have to be. Because, like, the next weekend, you know, they had the booth up with the balloons. And like, we need children's pastors or whatever. Come join kids' ministry. So I did. And it's so funny, you know, just, like, all throughout my life and my walk with God. And he knows what he's working with. So it's just slow-pitch softball. I mean, he's not giving me hard ones, you know. He's kind of really taking care of me. So, yeah, I started studying. Because on Sundays, I was like, oh, I'm militant. I'm wearing a full suit because I don't know what children's ministry is. So I'm in a full suit, and I'm studied up. I've got all the PowerPoint presentations built. I've got curriculum. Like, I'm hitting this thing hard. Everybody else would just go in there, feed them some snacks. We're going to sing some songs. These kids aren't, we're not here to talk about God, because it's a big church, and I didn't know that they weren't actually, like, into the Bible or whatever. So... So anyway, children's ministry, God softened my heart, and through building presentations to talk to these, I think it was third and fourth grade kids, that's how God broke my heart. And he was able to circumcise my heart, and I found God, and I found his son Jesus, and I got baptized in Jesus' name on my 32nd birthday. It was a beautiful thing. So I absolutely love it, but I owe it to not wanting my kids to, you know, like, be molested in a church or whatever. Yeah. So, and that's how God brought me to Christianity. He's like, hey, look, I'm obviously, you're not working with a full toolbox, but here, let me just go easy on you and give you, let me start you off where the kids are at so you can build a foundation.
Were you learning in the children's ministry, just like sitting in the back, or you were actually teaching and you were like learning as you're teaching?
Yeah, the first time I'd ever read a Christian Bible was to give a Sunday school class to a bunch of kids.
So they really didn't care that you weren't even a Christian yet, and that you're just totally uninformed on how things are supposed to go. They're just like, all right, you're alive and you're willing, so why don't you do it?
Yeah, they
said, that's incredible.
Hey, yeah, well, I'm covered in tattoos. I've got a long beard, a shaved head. You know, I look like I'm fresh out of prison, and it's on purpose, because back where I used to be in life, the tougher you looked, the less people were likely to mess with you. I call it urban camouflage. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to look tough all the time, and now I'm just like a teddy bear, and I eat ice cream. You know, I got three kids, and I'm doing kids sports, and I'm as soft as you can be nowadays. But I still look like a jerk. And so they said, well, we got to do a background check on you, but if it comes back clean, we'd be more than happy that you're back there. We need anybody, you know, boots on the ground. We need 100 people back in that hallway. Yeah, I mean, I've never been in trouble as an adult. I was in a ton of trouble as a youth. I dropped out of school because I spent so much time in juvenile, and I was in and out of, you know, juvenile all the time. And when I was in or out, I knew everybody who was in and out. So I was making poor decisions. But as an adult, after the military, I mean, that really changed my whole life. Like, I shaped up.
So after you became a Christian, you started to, at some point, listen to the sermons of the preacher. Is that true?
No. I spent about a year and a half back with the kids.
Okay.
And I was just burning it up. So I started reading the Bible. The first time I'd ever read the Bible was to give these presentations to the kids. And once I started reading about it, it was blowing my mind. You know, you read the New Testament. For me, servant leadership is the foundation of everything I want to do in life. I love it. It is a fire for me. My degrees and stuff, they're in ministry, but also in leadership. I'm in a graduate leadership program right now. I want to get a PhD in organizational leadership, but a couple years off from that. But I'm working on it. But anyway, so I started reading the Bible just because I wanted to give a good presentation to these children. It wasn't their fault they had to be there for an hour, but while they were there, we were going to learn the Bible. because that's what I thought you did in church. So I started reading this stuff, and I was just blown. I couldn't put it down. I loved it. And it lit a fire in me. I accepted Christ. I got saved. And I just kept doing the kid stuff. I was back there in the children's wing. Stuff was fun. I was coaching youth sports through the church. I still do to this day, even though I left the church, you know, many years ago. But yeah, I just absolutely loved it. And once I found out who Christ was and what he'd done for us through his finished works, it just radicalized my whole life. Mm-hmm. And so I was both feet in, and I have been ever since.
So tell us about how you first encountered some of these ideas about the Trinity, or the idea that Jesus is both God and man at the same time. Where did you hear those, and how did it seem to you?
Well, the weirdest thing for us was the only time we would hear that stuff, like we would go to Easter service or Christmas service or the big ones, because I was teaching third and fourth graders, and my wife was down with, I think, first and second grade. I think she was younger kids. She's got a bigger tolerance than I do. But we were pretty much in the children's wing, and we were loving it. We had friends and we had a community and all this good stuff. And we were both just ripping through the Bible and just loving it. But then we would go to main service on the big ones, or we would, if we were teaching in the mornings, maybe we would then go in the afternoon service and hear the main service. And we were just like dumbfounded. We didn't know what they were even talking about. Like they would say these ideas. We were like, what is this person even like? What, that doesn't make sense to anybody. Well, we were incorrect. I guess that makes sense to a lot of people, but we would hear these ideas. Like that. I remember the last church service my wife went to, she got up and we walked out. It was Easter service, and they said, God died. And she was like, nah, I'm good. I'm out of here. I'm like, okay, well, whatever. You know, I also don't want to be in here. So we walked out. But, yeah, we hear things like the standard Christmas service where God was born. I've never read that anywhere. Like, and we understood, like, hey, we're new at this. Maybe we're just not getting something.
Right.
So I would ask questions about it. And so by this time, I was already on they call it the leadership and development team of the church. It's what most people call elders, but this is a mega church, so it all sounds funny. But I was on the leadership team. I was teaching Sunday school. I was running my ministry out of the building, veteran support ministry, coaching the kids' sports, all that stuff. And so I had been assigned a mentor for the leadership and development team, because you work your way through the elder, and then you're like the senior elders and your assistant to the pastors and all that stuff. And I was the deacon of outreach ministry for them as well. And all this time, I didn't understand. I didn't know enough to know that I was different. I just thought what they were saying wasn't really making sense. And then I'd ask them about it, and you'd get the standard response of that. Well, you got to take it all or leave it all. Or, you know, this is foundational doctrine. I said, all right, man, here's the thing, dude. I want to know better. And you're telling me there's a different way. So just walk me through it.
Right.
And then they would just give some crazy, unexplainable, the mystery of the faith and all this stuff. And I was like, no, man, that doesn't say that in the Bible. And then so you say that enough times. And as you know, and I just didn't know, you know, the doctrine of the Trinity, to me, it's a different religion. To me, it's a different God. It's a false God. But to them, it's the foundation of their faith. And so if you're asking questions about it and saying things like it's not real, they view you as not a Christian.
Yeah.
Even though I had been baptized in the name of Jesus, I was obviously all the fruit of my words is like positive Christian stuff. But because I didn't believe in the Trinity, an idea that they could not explain to me, I was somehow not a Christian. I was like, what? You know, and so we're both starting to take offense. And at that point, hey man, I'm sorry, this ain't for me anymore. If you're not going to preach what the Bible teaches, and you're going to get offended and not trust me because I believe in the word of God instead of the pastor, then it's just not going to fit. You know?
So would you say that you were a biblical Unitarian by default?
Yeah.
Was, just from reading the Bible?
It was from the jump. We didn't know any better. We didn't know modalism. We didn't know Trinitarianism.
Right.
I didn't have any clue what that stuff was. Mm-hmm.
Not that you would use that word, because you wouldn't say Unitarian. You would just say this other stuff doesn't make sense.
Yeah, I was like, dude, we're just really passionate Christians. Like, yeah. We're into this thing. The Bible is, it's what we do. This is my, like, this is my hobby. You know, this, I read the Bible for fun. So my wife talks about it in Mark Cain's podcast, the UCA podcast. It was a big moment for her. And I didn't know any different. She said, man, why do people say that Jesus and God are the same thing if Jesus is talking to God and praying to God? And when he's baptized, God says something about Jesus. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, oh, well, back then I'll use a little cruder language than I'll use here. But I was like, oh, I was just like, man, they don't know any better. You know, they're not reading the same Bible we are, I guess. Turns out, you know, 99% of Christianity actually believes that. That we were just the ones who didn't. Mm-hmm.
So how did you first come across the idea of biblical Unitarianism and like getting to learn about more people that were like you?
Well, it was a year or two of isolation. And because we understood that we couldn't be part of a mainstream Trinitarian Christian church, even though we didn't even still at this point, we didn't know they were Trinitarian. We just thought that all churches, I don't even know how to explain it back then. We just, what we heard we tried a ton, and what we heard at all the church services were not what we were reading in the Bible. So we just said, well, we're good. We'll just do our own thing. And, you know, I guess we didn't get this Christian thing figured out. My wife somehow came across a book by a guy named John Lynn, and it was Don't Blame God. Mm-hmm. And there was a lot of stuff in that book where she was like, oh my God, this dude gets it. He sounds like us. And so, yeah, funny story, you know, I just hunted him down. I tracked him, you know, I found him in the real world. And I said, hey, do you want to have dinner? You know, I've got a lot of questions. He said, sure, what day? Do you want to meet tonight? You know, what day of the week do you want to meet up? Because he's from Indianapolis and so are we. We didn't know at that point, and I don't want to badmouth all these other things and these groups or whatever. Everybody's got good contributions, but I didn't know what the Way International was. And to me, John Lynn was a very good friend and a very good person. I met him way later in life, and I was actually friends with him when he died. Knowing what I know now, that relationship would have eventually turned south because I'm not a tongue-speaking dispensation. Like, I don't hold the doctrines in the Way and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. And I think that they're like false teaching, and I don't like that group at all. But back then, he was just a really good person who wanted to see us grow in our faith. And so I think through him, we found the term biblical Unitarian. But once you have the proper Google search term, then you can find guys like J. Dan Gill and Anthony Buzzard. And there's like a video of you when you're 14 talking to J. Dan Gill in a suit.
Oh, man.
But once you find the culture, then you feel like, oh, my God, we're not alone. There's more people out there. Mm-hmm. That we're not just kooky, you know, people who aren't getting the Bible right. Now we can actually have foundation to stand on and say, no, there's more people that believe this kind of thing. And that's how it all started.
Yeah. Very good. So let's talk about the book. It's called The Cost of Truth, Stories of Biblical Unitarian Christians, with Seneca Harbin and contributors. You've got Bill Schlegel, Will Barlow, Johnny Barnes, Seth Ross, Suzanne Lakin, Candace Tuggy, and Ryan Russell. Endorsements, myself, Dale Tuggy, John Shainheit, and did you know that you are the number one new release in Unitarian Universalism? Congratulations. This book has nothing to do with Unitarian Universalism, and yet you have dominated the UU charts. So, you know, let me be the first and probably the last to congratulate you on that.
Thank you. There's this guy, he's a motivational speaker, and his name's E.T. And he's famous for saying, winners win. And so whether we win in new book releases or just in Unitarian Universalism, it's a victory. I'm going to take it.
We'll just take
I'm still
it.
Proud of it.
Yeah. I think if a Unitarian Universalist picked up the book, well, first of all, the title of the book is very non-universalist, The Cost of Truth. It presupposes that there is such a thing as truth and that it costs something. And then, yeah, if they do pick it up, they'll be really shocked by the content. But let's talk about this book. Who did you have in mind when you were putting this together? Like, what sort of person were you thinking would really benefit?
So I'll tell you the backstory. I got to kind of go a little further back than that question.
Okay.
When I became, you know, a hardcore Christian, I really got lit on fire. I approached one of my, back then he was my buddy. I said, hey man, you do this thing, you know, cause I wanted to break into ministry and I didn't know how. And so I would meet with pastors and they're like, oh, all you gotta do is just go get a doctorate, you know, become some PhD, spend the next 20 years of your life. I was like, hey, I don't have time for that. And Jesus didn't either. And so how do we figure this out? And so I talked to this guy who ran a homeless ministry. And the only reason I'm telling this story is because it leads into it. But so he was like, well, what do you feel like you have authority in? What are you comfortable with? I said, well, all I know is the veteran community. Because in my, I'm a secular, you know, I work in the secular environment. I'm the director of Veterans Affairs. All I do is veterans. On a board member of Veterans Corps, and all, you know, all this stuff. So I was like, well, I feel comfortable in the veteran community. That's my people. You know, I get that environment. And he's like, well, then why don't you just do that? Oh, okay. So on the ride home, I call my wife. Hey, I'm starting a veterans ministry. We're starting a nonprofit, this and that. She's like, oh, all right, that's great. You know, I hope it works for you. Yeah, whatever. She's always really supportive. I just go off on these random, like, hey, we're doing this. You know, and God has blessed it and it's worked out. So anyway, years ago, I started that thing, Veteran Support Ministry. Then years later, this guy split off from the church he was going to and started his own. And he was like, hey, will you come be one of the ministers here at the church? Will you run the children's ministry? And I'll be the main preacher. I was like, oh, dude, what, anything, you know, it's cool. And at the time, I told him, I said, well, hey, I'm a licensed pastor for the Church of God General Conference. I'm a biblical Unitarian. He's like, great. I believe in Jesus too. I need a pastor. Can you just come over and help me out? And there's no pay. Okay, yeah, I'll be there, dude. So anyway, so I'm just helping a friend out. Well, a stupid thing I do on Facebook is I don't watch television. So I always just read books instead. And when people meet me in person, they're like, oh, I didn't know you could read. So, but I.
And you do I read always, a lot of books because you always post what you're reading. Yeah.
I love it. Absolutely love it. But a lot of these books I'm reading aren't mainstream stuff. And they're kind of far out ideas. I do a lot of chaplaincy work in part of my several ministries that I do now, but I do a lot of chaplaincy work, and I feel that it's important for me to be able to meet you where you're at so that we can go forward together. Like, I don't have to agree with you, but if I don't understand where you're coming from, I'm going to miss a lot of what you're saying. Mm-hmm. And so I read a lot of books that maybe I don't necessarily agree with. So anyway, I was posting this review, like, hey, I just read this book. It's great. Whatever. Here's some key points of it. And one of the members of that church took offense to whatever. I think that book was about Christian Universalism or whatever, which is the most beautiful lie that I could ever come up. I mean, it sounds so
a beautiful good. Idea. Yeah.
Yeah. It sounds beautiful, but it's a lie. And so a lot of those people are going to find out the hard way that maybe it ain't so, So anyway, they did kind of a deep dive into me and Church of God and what Unitarianism was. So if I find myself in a meeting, buddy calls me up, hey, brother, can we get lunch? I need to talk. oh yeah, cool, man. I thought this dude was gonna confide in me and like we were gonna work through some stuff. Maybe there was budgeting issues at the church or, you know, the standard Christian stuff. Well, it was not that. It was, you know, when you told me you were a biblical Unitarian, I didn't know what that meant. What are you teaching the kids? And I was like, well, you have my syllabus every week. Like, we were literally going chapter through chapter of Matthew. We're only speaking about the Bible. I'm not giving them what my opinion is because it's different than yours, but I'm preaching at your church, so I respect your boundaries and all that good stuff. And he was like, yeah, man, I've been reading about Mormonism and Jehovah's Witnesses. I was like, dude, I'm not a Mormon. I'm not a Jehovah's Witness. It's not any of that stuff. I was like, we agree on most points, I think. You know, we agree that you have to confess faith in Jesus. We agree that you should take communion. We agree that you should get water baptized. I said, so the key element stuff, we're pretty much the same. And he was like, hey, you can't teach anymore. I was like, that's weird because you asked me and I told you all this stuff up front. Yeah. And he's like, hey, it is what it is, dude. He's like, I'm either you can get fired or we can both get fired and it's not worth it to me. Like, all right, cool. I respect it. You know, whatever. It's cool. So that was like the fourth or fifth church that we'd been asked to leave for the belief system we had. And so I was like, you know what, dude, this is not an isolated event. By that time, we knew so many people in the Unitarian community. I was like, dude, let's just all get together and write a book about our experiences. So the end user I had in mind was three people. It was people who had not yet come to the faith of Unitarianism, didn't understand it, and thought it was some crazy, evil, wicked thing. And I just wanted to clear that stuff up. Like, no, these are the most devout Christians you can find. These people are into what they're into. The second one was for people who had been in the community for a while and they can just get a good laugh about all the dumb stuff that happens. Because we've all been there. We've all had our little, you know, everybody's lost a degree or been thrown out of a church or get kicked out of Thanksgiving dinner, you know, whatever it may be. And then also for someone who might be considering like, hey, I don't feel that what I'm being taught is right. I think there's something else out there, but I don't want to jump all the way in. And so hopefully those three segments of people can really benefit from the book.
Okay. And you talk about different stages that people go through when they become biblical Unitarian. Could you share a little bit about those? This is the part, 5 easy steps to lose friends and isolate yourself.
Yeah. I'm the type of guy, and again, it just stems from the military culture. Everything's a joke. The more serious the situation, the more you're making fun of it. And it's really just a coping mechanism. So in the book, like the original title and the original idea and all this stuff that I had was, I was going to do a spoof of the book, How to Win Friends and Influence People. But yeah, so my spoof, my spoof was How to Lose Friends and Isolate Yourself. You know? And I thought biblical Unitarianism was a good way to do that. So step one, finding fault in the current belief system. Everybody's had that aha moment where they thought, that's not what the book says. Like, I know what that guy just said. But what is dual naturism? Like, why would God have to put on flesh? Like, this stuff don't add up. Mm-hmm. And so just everybody has that moment. Well, that moment can be a great thing or it can take you on a ride that you're not ready for. And so that's step two, searching for truth. When you get into the searching for truth phase, oh my goodness. I know that you have met a lot of people. I think a lot of people find you first. You're one, and I don't mean none of this. Like I'm being kind when I say this kind of stuff, but there's probably 4 celebrity biblical Unitarians and you're one of them. And so a lot of people, cause you put out so much content that people are going to run into you as one of the first people. So you meet a lot of people who are searching for truth and they're on fire and they're ripping through everything they can read and they're just soaking it all up. And so that oftentimes, unfortunately, because we're humans, that leads us to step three, which is gaining knowledge and becoming prideful. That is a really tough step for a lot of people. And just to throw another dig at the Way International, that's where I think those dudes are stuck. And so, they are so prideful and just uppity. It blows my mind. You can't have a conversation. Once you find fault and then you search for the truth and find it, then you think, oh, now I've got to share this with everyone. No, you don't. You should give it a couple years, get a good foundation, let yourself work through a lot of things that you won't believe in 6 months anyway. And don't burn every bridge you have when you first become a biblical Unitarian. Just save yourself that heartache. So step three, finding truth and becoming prideful, leads directly to step four, trying to share your faith with others and being obnoxious about it.
And you could testify to having gone through that stage.
All of them.
Yeah.
Every one of them. I goofed them all up. I made all the worst mistakes. I left a lot of stuff out of this book because I'm going to tell you this, and I know most people spit on the floor when they hear it. I think if your book is over 200 pages, you need to refine it. You don't have a well-refined idea, so don't sell it to me, you know? So I wanted the book to be short, and so I left a lot of stuff out. But I butchered every step in this book, and I think a lot of people do. Mm-hmm. But yeah, when you get to step four, oh my God, these people aren't saved. They believe in a false god. They're mm-hmm. Greek pagan worshipers. That conversation has never went over good, right. Ever. You're not going to win anybody with the apologetics. I think Anthony Buzzard used to say, you can't get to hear from there. There's so many things in the Unitarian world. If you take all the lenses off and just read the Bible, you know, when you talk about the coming kingdom of God and the sleep of the dead and that Jesus was a man, they cannot handle all that in one spoonful. I mean, it's too much. You can't give it to them like that. You tell somebody that you think when you die, you die, and the whole point of Jesus coming back is the resurrection of the dead, they cannot meet you there. That's too far for them. They just can't do it. So step five, unfortunately, is losing friends, isolating yourself. And it's a twofold thing. One is because no one else shares the same truth as you, and you're just too obnoxious, and everyone else is wrong but you. And we've all lost friends to that. And I think maybe that's part of growing older. You just get so hard-lined in your rigid faith that no one else can be right. Or you just say, man, there's no one to fellowship with, so why even try? And you become one of the internet trolls that we all love so much. I'm surprised the UCA webpage, even the Facebook page, even exists because of all the Unitarian trolls.
Yeah. So maybe you can tell us a little bit about the recruitment process. Why did you decide to recruit others to share their stories, and how did you figure out all that?
That was actually a really easy process for me. And the only person that said no to the book only said no to it because he's working on a project that he didn't want to detract from. So J. Dan Gill, I really wanted a oneness person in there. I wanted a former oneness person in there, but I couldn't get it. And so what I really wanted to do was biblical Unitarian. God, that's a broad term. That you could understand that the Trinity is not a true Christian doctrine, and still be on a whole spectrum of other, what you would call truths, you know, that I don't think are listed in the Bible. But so it's really important. So that during the recruitment process, I said, well, let me get somebody from each category that I can think of. I failed in two regards. One was Christadelphians. I didn't get one of those in there, and I didn't get a former oneness person in there. But the other broad spectrum of Unitarianism, I think we did a really good job. Bill, he's from the most strict, farthest conservative group, the Master Seminary, Will Barlow, Former Way. I actually had a ton of people I really wanted for that chapter, but I didn't want the whole book to sound like X-Way converts or whatever. So if I left you out, I didn't mean to. A couple of people know who I'm talking about. I'm really good friends with a lot of people who have since left that organization. But Johnny Barnes, that's a great story. It's tragic, but it's true. Put in all this work and then through seminary, actually figured out, oh, wow, this is incorrect. This is all wrong.
Yeah.
Susan, that's just a put your seatbelt on for that chapter. It's all over the place. It's such a good story. Mm-hmm. She sheds a lot of light to several cultures, which I really appreciate. Candace is such a unique story. I know that she had to leave a bunch out because they're one of the celebrity, you know, groups and all that stuff. And it's just a lot of these people, I got to understand, this book is in print forever. Like, this is always a thing.
Yeah.
And so while I was willing to share a lot of gritty details about my life, I left a lot of stuff out too. And we all did. So Candace's story is beautiful. And then Ryan, he was ex-Jehovah's Witness. And so we really covered a whole spectrum of biblical Unitarianism. And that was kind of the recruitment process. Seth was one of those guys where I thought, okay, I've only covered negative aspects. This guy is at the top of the top for his denomination, and it always went right. It was all good. It was loving home. It was faith from birth. And now he's at the top of the organization. And, you know, God's hand was in it. Everybody was just like, dude, it went back to, well, I'm surprised you can read and you're writing a book. Yeah, sure. I know that your chapter is going to make mine look so good because you can't even speak English. So I'm going to look like a theologian if I'm in this book. So everybody said yes to it. And I'm really thankful that they were all willing to be part of it.
What's your hope for the book? What would you, if you could dream and talk about what this book would do in the world, what would you like to see? And also, let me ask you, have you already started to think about future editions with other stories of folks?
I'll loop back into that second part. But okay. So what I would like to see for the book, I want people to know it's okay to be different. I want people to understand that just because what you see isn't what everybody else sees doesn't mean it's wrong. And if you're willing to endure it, it's painful. If you don't have a community to support you, it'll prune you. You're going to get a lot of branches cut off, but it's not a bad thing and it's all worth it. So that would be my hope. And then also, I don't know, this isn't public and not that it's like reserved or anything, but 100% of any dollar that I ever receive from it in any way, I don't gain anything. I immediately turn it back into the Lord's Harvest International. The people overseas are, you know, overseas is a hard life. It is a life that I don't have to live just by a geographical blessing by itself. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying, you know, God isn't with them or nothing like that, but just geographically in America, I don't have needs or wants. I don't have real problems. I've got Western problems. But I didn't get eaten by a lion yesterday, and I know where my next meal is going to come. You know, all this, I've got running water, I've got electricity. And the Lord's harvest is just such a blessing to a lot of people that wouldn't otherwise be able to exist. And so 100% of the money from this on my end is going straight to them. And I'm like allergic to money anyway, so, you know, I don't even want it.
But your wife but might not same. Be, so.
Oh, God, is she... She isn't. She sure isn't. She's the financial advisor of the relationship.
Yeah, yeah. So I was thinking about folks that have either grown up with this idea about the oneness of God and Jesus being a human being instead of a God-man, and also others that have just believed in it for a long time. And I think this book, too, can be super encouraging and challenging to folks who are complacent and who are saying, oh yeah, I already know that, I already believe in that, because what the book documents is all these really powerful stories of real people in recent history that are changing their mind on this issue. And so I think it might encourage, maybe light a fire under some of us to get out there and open our mouths a little bit and not just be like, oh, well, who cares, or it'll all be fine. So hopefully that will occur as well. Do you have any future projects you're working on that you can share about, or what are you up to these days?
Well, I just in the ministerial world, I preach at a senior citizens community. I'm a local police agency chaplain. I do youth Christian sports. I run veteran support ministry, Christian center counseling, and some other things that I'm leaving out. But what I'm actually about 80% done with my second book. It's The Lost Truth of Biblical Unitarianism. I'm republishing John Biddle's 1654 Catechism and just giving a summary of each chapter. And then at the conclusion of the book is going to be where I think we've went astray. We've put so much additional doctrine and emphasis on things that the father of English Unitarianism didn't value for whatever reason. And so what the original mindset and foundational doctrine that we're supposed to carry, most people, like I can ask 8 out of 10 biblical Unitarians, they don't even know who John Biddle is. I'm like, this is everything you should believe. Like, it's so good. It's so rich. But yeah, I'm going to finish that this month and then have it all to the person. I've got two people in mind that I want to do the foreword for it. Mm-hmm. And they both knew. So I used the 2001 retype that Alan Maxwell did of the 1654. Because as you know, it's pretty rough. A couple of English letters didn't exist back then. So it kind of sounds kooky when you read it. Alan Maxwell did a 2001 retype. So I'm using that for the base deck. And then I've got two people that actually knew him in real life. I only emailed with him back and forth because he lived in Australia when I met him. I don't know if he always lived there. So I've got two people that knew him in real life. I want them to write the foreword for the book. But yeah, that'll be done this year. So I'm excited about that. And then what I learned in this book was that when I'm done with the book and when it's a finished product is two different things. I'm giving someone a piece of coal and they are refining it and making it look good and timeless and evergreening it. And so that's just something that I'm very thankful for and I'm very appreciative of, but it wasn't, I just didn't know what I didn't know. And so when I get done with the book and send it off to somebody, you know, maybe 25-ish, 26, it'll come out.
I'm
actually hoping that book will be used at Atlanta Bible College later on in life. I hope that it's important enough to teach people who are going to then teach people how biblical Unitarianism came to be in the West, at least so that they could, even if they don't agree with it, they could still understand where it came from.
Yeah. And we should give Anna Brown a shout out, who did a lot of work on the cost of truth in that turning coal to diamonds process and just wrangling all these specialists and professionals to do all this, the work that goes into a project like this. And so thanks to Anna Brown for that. I encourage all of you out there to get your copy of The Cost of Truth. It's a great book. It'll encourage you. It'll challenge you. And I think it's the sort of book you can, I don't know if you could give it to like just a random evangelical and see what they think, but it definitely has evangelistic potential. What do you think, Seneca? You think you just hand it to like a Baptist and see what they do?
I think so. I didn't know that when I wrote the book. But since I've talked to people who've read it, it's such a soft entry into the world of biblical Unitarianism. It's not a 600-page tome of doctrine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
it's just real stories of real people. And it's, hey, this is another option. And if you've never heard of it or considered it, it's a real thing. It has real biblical basis. And maybe check it out. Yeah. And so I hope it'll be a soft enough entry to where people, then that's kind of the where the first book came from, where the second book is going. First book is a soft entry into overall biblical Unitarianism. The second book is going to be, this is what the foundation started as. And whether you're still there or not, that's okay. I'm not saying you're right or wrong, but at least know what you're supposed to know first.
I think with your early material, like introduction, chapter one, that really does define well what biblical Unitarianism is as far as like what we think we are. And here's a funny thing. We bought a Facebook ad, Living Hope did, who was the publisher of the book. And on the Facebook ad for the book, there were multiple Trinitarian trolls came on and said, biblical Unitarian, ha, 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 what a contradiction. What they're laughing at is that like Unitarian is so often associated with people who don't believe in the Bible. They say biblical Unitarian, you know, rubs them the wrong way. Or perhaps they think wrongfully that the Trinity is the biblical teaching. And so Unitarian can't possibly be biblical. There was another person on there that also made a very negative comment. And it's like, struck me as so ironic because here you have people that are justifying the need for this book by doing the thing that the book is sent is sort of like making the public aware of, like, hey, this truth costs you something. You're going to get made fun of. You could get kicked out of a church. You could lose job opportunities, especially in ministry, and lots of other consequences. So I think it's definitely proved its value even just in that ad, which is funny. But thanks so much for talking with me today, Seneca. I wish you the best with this project and the next one and the next one and the next one. You don't seem like the type to just slow down and just say, all right, that's good. It's a good thing. I appreciate you talking with me.
I would like to end on just a note of gratitude. You mentioned Anna Brown earlier. I mentioned her in the book. There's a couple people I threw their names out there because no matter how our relationship ends up, at the point in time, they were so helpful and so foundational and all that good stuff. Anna Brown has helped me in so many aspects of my life. She is a bedrock of positivity and a growth mindset. Mm-hmm. She's extremely assertive and just has this driver mentality. And that's the group of people that I'm always attracted to the most. I always want to be in their presence, which is unhealthy because you can't have a room full of drivers. But I just love the thought process and the mentality of, yes, here's an idea. Let's get it. You know, let's get after it.
Yeah.
And so with this book, with a little Bible study we had in the house back a couple of years ago with Christian Center Counseling, Anna has been there in my corner the whole time. Mm-hmm. And a lot of things that are successful today are successful because of her. And so I really appreciate it.
Yeah.
And I really appreciate everybody who was a co-author in the book and had any, obviously, Living Hope, the publisher. We couldn't do it. A lot of things in life, people think, because we live in this Western culture where we think me, me, me all the time. That's not real. Like, I couldn't be where I'm at today without all the people in my corner and my family and the people like Anna Brown and Living Hope as the publisher and the co-authors who were willing to do it. And all of the people who have come way before me, all the theologians, and you know, John Biddle, for him to publish that work that he did back in 1600, it was the cost of his life.
Yeah, it cost him his life.
So, and today's October 6th, Tyndale, he got smoked for translating the Bible into English. So, like, all the people who came before me, I'm just trying to recirculate some of the truth that I believe should be out there.
Yeah.
It's not my idea. It's not something I came up with. And I couldn't do it without all the support of everybody else. So I really appreciate everybody.
Well, that brings this interview to an end. What did you think? Come on over to restitutio.org and find episode 569, The Cost of Truth, and leave your feedback there. Also, if you don't mind, please share this episode with others who you think would benefit from listening to it. On last week's episode called The Witch of Endor and the Rich Man and Lazarus Parable with Dustin Smith and Sam Tiedemann,
someone using the moniker Taxpaying Christian says, thanks for hosting this cordial discussion. Well, let me just pause it there. We had a comment come through the week before by someone using the name Tax Evader or something like that. So this person is playing off of that. You have to check out the episode from last week if you missed that. Anyhow, this person says, it's not every day that we can hear 2 to 3 people respectfully disagreeing on important subjects and still be able to walk away as friends. My question has to do with the correct method for understanding difficult Bible verses. At the conclusion, Sean praised Sam for taking Luke 16 at face value. Mr. Smith, on multiple occasions, attempted to set the passages in their context, e.g. the poetry that dominates the prophet Isaiah, the Deuteronomistic history of 1 Samuel as it relates to the theology of Deuteronomy, the contemporary Egyptian parallel story to Luke 16, and the prodigal son's death and resurrection. Can you help me understand why taking a difficult passage at face value is the better method than striving to set verses in their context? Please help me see what I am missing. Thank you for the good show. Well, the simple answer is that it's not a difficult text if you believe the afterlife Jesus described in the parable is the afterlife that the Bible teaches in other places and that everyone's going to experience. It's always a kind of special pleading when we say this or that is a difficult text and therefore we need to employ extra moves to explain it. And Sam doesn't do that. He just reads the passage as it's written and then says, this is what I believe. Since I disagree with Sam, I'm going to go on the record as saying the problem with doing that is that it goes against what Jesus explicitly says in other places, in particular with respect to the historical Lazarus, whom he says is asleep when he's dead. And if somebody's asleep, they're not awake, which is what the Lazarus in the parable and the rich man were. They were both awake. They were not asleep in the intermediate state. Taking it at face value is generally a good approach. But when you do have a contradiction where you will either have to say that Jesus is contradicting himself and just making mistakes, or one of the two is being misinterpreted, I'm going to go with number two of those two options. So I think that's my hermeneutical justification for taking a deeper look at the exegesis, and then when we do find out about this floating story of two dead people whose fates are reversed and the popularity of this fable or parable, not only in Egypt, but also in Israel, where it was commonly told, we do start to justify not taking the parable as describing actual events in the underworld. So that would be my approach. And I hope I clarified where I was coming from in my remarks about Sam having the advantage in taking the passage at face value. Suzanne Lakin writes in saying, well, very insightful. I was delightfully surprised to find I am in disagreement with all three of you regarding the Witch of Endor account. Well, first of all, Suzanne, I don't know why that makes you delighted, but maybe you just enjoy the struggle. She goes on, I am absolutely a physicalist, and I take Yahweh at his word when he tells humans, from dust you are, and to dust you will return. I'd like to suggest, as I've heard many proponents of open theism, which I also embrace, we should avoid limiting God. Those who oppose open theism state that God couldn't possibly create a world in which he limits his very own knowledge in order to have authentic relationships with his humans. Yet he must, to allow for free will. And I believe the Bible provides incontrovertible evidence that God chooses to not know the future, to react in real time to how his creatures act. Similarly, to say God is incapable of recreating an individual from the dust, giving her all her prior memories, and making her the same person and not a clone is to limit God. There truly is, from my humble perspective, nothing at all anywhere in Scripture that indicates humans are in some conscious state or actually exist in any form at all. If we are but dust and return to dust, we need to ask, what is the sleeping or subconscious state of dust? Does the Bible say dust has some secret actual conscious or sleeping state? Wouldn't God have told his creatures from Adam onward that when they die, some part of them is really still in existence? Why can't we allow for the euphemism of sleep to be merely a descriptor to indicate humans are not eternally gone but still exist in God's mind such that he can, at any time, and he has set a time, recreate them as if awakening them from sleep? So much more to be said on this, but if you are going to do a Four Views book, I volunteer to give an alternative view that I believe is aligned with the entirety of Scripture. Oh, and a lot to say about the parable of the rich man, too. Grateful for these wonderful, respectful dialogues and for all three of you humble men of God. Well, thanks for writing in, Suzanne Lakin. I have to admit, I am unsatisfied with your explanation of the clone problem. Now, once again, let me explain it. I scan your DNA and I make another body that is identical to your current body at its current age. Every facet exactly the same. I make this in a laboratory of regular human biological material. And then I scan your brain and I ensure that the brain of the clone has exactly the same memories and wrinkles, or however brains work, I don't know. And then I wake up that person and I say, "Hello, Suzanne. Good morning." Is that Suzanne Lake in you? No, of course not. You're in your home in California, just leading your life, doing the things. This is another you. It's a clone. It is not you. It is a copy of you that has the same memories and thinks that she is Suzanne as well. But she's not Suzanne because you already exist in another place at the same time. That's the clone problem. So how does that relate to resurrection? Well, all we do is allow for time in between those two events. So if somebody dies and then they're resurrected and the resurrection involves recreation, then that is the same thing as just having a clone, not at the same time as you, but as at a different time than you, and then saying that's you. But it's still a clone. That's easy to see because there is no you that survived to become the clone, to become the resurrected person. So that is the problem. And look, if God is just going to clone us in resurrection, then, you know, I'm sure the clone of me will have a great life in the resurrection. But what about me? What about my faith and everything else? This is also called the transporter problem from Star Trek, just to throw that out there, where basically you break somebody down into their constituent atoms, and then you beam the information, and that person is essentially recreated in a transporter in another location. So basically, the transporter problem is the same idea where somebody dies and is recreated over and over and over again, but like that person has not experienced continuity throughout. So like you're just killing and cloning the person over and over and over again, which I think is not really what people want when they're just looking for transportation. Now, Suzanne makes some interesting points about you come from dust and you go to dust. I'm not disputing that. We certainly do come from dust. What of us comes from dust? Our bodies. I think that's clear. Our bodies and our brains and so forth come from dust. But I think we have something more than just a body happening. I think there's also a mind. In some ways, clearly relates to the brain, but it's not exactly one-to-one equivalent. And I think that's a spiritual entity. You could call it a soul. I'm not super comfortable with using that term. I just rather prefer to use mind. And that seems to also be the case. And how that relates to the brain, that's deeper than what I'm looking to get into here. I'm just saying, look, if there is such a thing as a mind, such a thing as your consciousness that can be stewarded by God throughout the intermediate state, in whatever way he sees fit to do that, obviously in a dormant sense because it's described as sleep, then you can have the same person in the resurrection so long as the mind part of the person or some part of the mind of the person that would represent their consciousness is able to survive the death state. She talks about to dust, and so I don't really struggle with that. And then she says, nothing anywhere in Scripture indicates humans are in some conscious state. Well, I think that's arguable. The term sleep, as she rightly points out, is a euphemism. You're not actually asleep when you're dead. But asleep people aren't dead, right? So there is possibly a hint here in the term sleep. And the Jews did have this idea of Sheol, and it was a place where the dead are, even though their bodies are decaying in their tombs. The people are in this storage chamber or whatever you want to call it. So I think there is something there in scripture. I don't think this is just like made up whole cloth by the philosophers. And then she goes on to say, the Bible doesn't talk about a secret conscious or sleeping state. Well, I think it does. I mean, wasn't that kind of Sam's point about Isaiah 14 and the Witch of Endor? Well, I think Sam's point is that they both talk about consciousness in the intermediate state. But I think Dustin's point, which was even more strongly sustained, was that actually these both give evidence that you're normally unconscious in the intermediate state. But in a hyperbolic Isaiah 14 kind of way, you could be awakened, or Isaiah could see somebody as being awakened. Oh, here's the tough guy that terrified everybody on earth. And now you're just like the rest of us who are just awaiting the final judgment, who are awaiting our resurrection. It's not that Isaiah thought this actually happened, but like in order to write that sort of poetic scene in Isaiah 14, you have to sort of have something to work with, I would say. And so if there are consciousnesses or whatever that descended into another realm, another dimension, another reality, who knows how to describe this? I have no idea. You have something to work with to like wake them up and have them say, oh, here comes this other person who's now in the death state with us. And so also with the Witch of Endor, where Samuel appears to get awakened from sleep and he's rather disturbed by that and speaks and so forth. So that indicates that he is able to be awoken in the intermediate state, but it's really bad to do something like that. Saying that there's no scriptures about this is not necessarily the case. It depends on your interpretation. And then she goes on to say, wouldn't God have told his creatures from Adam onward that when they die, some part of them is really still in existence? Not necessarily. I think that's up to God, what he tells us. You know, a lot of this is speculation as far as like how God can preserve identity through the death experience. He doesn't owe us an explanation on how he's going to do that. And we might be able to think of other ways to do it. And maybe God's not using any of the ways that we're thinking of. And he's doing something else that we have no idea anything about, that we don't even have the capacity to imagine. That's his prerogative. The point is that when God resurrects you, he resurrects you and not just recreating a copy of you. And that we certainly saw with Jesus. With Jesus, he descended into Hades. He was dead for 3 days. And then when he came back, it wasn't like he constructed a new body out of nothing. He used the old remains of his previous body. And it was the same Jesus. He recognized people and he said, I was dead and now I'm alive. You know, like there is certainly the impression that we get of continuity there, of identity. So yeah, I don't think God is under any obligation to tell us. And then she says, why can't we have the euphemism of sleep to indicate humans are not eternally gone but still exist in God's mind such that he can at any time recreate them as if waking them from sleep? Actually, Suzanne, I think that's what I'm arguing. I think we're just arguing the same thing here. You say still exist in God's mind. That's what I'm trying to say. We have to still exist in some capacity, whether it's in God's mind, whatever that is, or as a disembodied soul in an underground chamber or something, or in some other way, some other technology we don't understand or don't have access to, whatever. That's not important, the how. My point is we have to still exist, because if you completely cease to exist in every sense of the word, the only thing that can happen in resurrection is a clone. And it's not a limitation on God. It's not me saying, oh, God can't do it. God can't make a square circle. That's not a limitation on God. There's just no such thing as a square circle. To be a square is to have four sides, and circles only have one side. So you can't, it's not like, oh, I'm limiting God here. No, I think if everything of you is completely dead, There is no way to preserve your identity through death. And it's not a limitation on God. So fussing about how exactly God does that, how does he preserve us through the intermediate state, I'm totally comfortable with just using the word sleep. We are asleep in the intermediate state, and then he wakes us up in the final state, in the resurrection, for life in the age to come. So maybe that was more than anybody wanted to hear. Suzanne, we'll definitely keep you in mind for a book on this subject if something like that ever did come along. I really appreciated your contribution in The Cost of Truth. And if any of you out there have not yet read Suzanne's chapter in The Cost of Truth, you got to read it. It's got UFOs, it's got Jehovah's Witnesses, it's got atheists, and Suzanne growing up as a Jew in Beverly Hills. I mean, it's just got everything. So you should definitely pick up The Cost of Truth and read Suzanne's chapter. Actually, read the whole book. That would be my recommendation. All right, well, that's going to be it for me, everyone. Thanks so much for tuning in. I hope to see a number of you at UCAcon 2024 coming up in a week. That's going to be a great time. Looking forward to that. Going to be presenting on Isaiah 9:6, and I will be posting my paper on restitutio.org next week at some point. So if you would like to read it, you can. See what you think about my take on Isaiah 9:6. Thanks, everybody, for listening to the end. If you'd like to support us, you can do that at restitutio.org. We'll catch you next week. And remember, the truth has nothing to fear.